Morning, Glory, Evening, Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. A special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Extended conversation with America's best-selling author, Vince Flynn. You've got an enormous number of New York Times bestsellers, including the current Extreme Measures out there. Phenomenally popular across the culture. You've heard Rush talking about them all the time. And you'll get addicted and hooked if you pick up any of them. And we get back to the chase here, Vince Flynn. I want to touch about Hollywood in just a second. But in terms of the research, you know, in the current book, I knew about the triple frontier because it's part of the world of terrorism and people worry about that region. How did you find out about it? How did you figure out how it works and why Al-Qaeda might want to go there? How'd you research it?
You know, Jeffrey Goldberg wrote a great article, when was it? 2-3 years ago in, I think it was Atlantic Monthly, and we have the same agent. So that was the first time I was aware of it. The other reason why I know about that stuff is I have been blessed with some really good contacts in the national security area. I think chiefly because people say, why do you think these guys talk to you? And I say, well, because I am not a partisan hack who wants to destroy the very institutions that I think are keeping us safe. So these guys are great. You know, and I spend a lot of time going out to D.C. And some other areas of the country where I sit down with these guys and we talk, and I just... We press each other on these issues. Where is it headed? Daniel Silva, you'll love this. I'm sure you've had this conversation with Daniel. Is I am always flabbergasted when somebody will say to me, how did you know? You know, how did you know that these terrorists were out there and they wanted to kill us? How did you? And I always look at him like, you know, all right. And Daniel and I laugh about this. Well, you know, we had this crazy idea that when they shot their AK-47 in the air and said death to America, that they actually meant it.
Well, you know, you bring up Silva, and this brings up one of the interesting notes I have here. Your books, all of your books that feature Ben Friedman and Mossad, have a very, I don't want to say ambivalent, but a very nuanced view of Mossad. It's very different from Silva's, which is, of course, featuring Gabriel Olone as an Mossad agent. Explain to people what you really think about Mossad and about Israel, and then we want to turn to the Saudis, another theme that moves through the books. I'm going out of order here, but you brought it up, let's go there.
I tell you what I think about Israel is anytime you look at Israel, if you want to give it the nuanced effect, you have to remember that they are their own country. And at the end of the day, they will do what is best for themselves. There is nothing either right or wrong about that. It simply is a fact, and it's the way it should be. Same with Saudi Arabia, same with us. People that actually think that Israel should just roll over and do whatever we want I think being really foolish. One of the chief mistakes I think people in this country make is that they don't put themselves in the shoes of what the Israelis go through. They don't literally understand the psychological scar of what they've been through, the fact that they're the people that want to wipe them off the face of the planet are like, you know, you're living in Westwood and they live in Pasadena, you know, and at any day they could come over the mountain range and shove you into the ocean and you would cease to exist as a people. And they've got leaders who swear that that's exactly what they want to do. Yep. It shocks me at times. So I have a deep, deep respect for Mossad. Are they always perfect? Absolutely not.
No, you've created Ben Friedman so that you can hate Ben Friedman and still like Israel. I kind of like that. I think that's actually.
You know what? It's funny that you say that. I like Ben Friedman. He's an interesting guy. He is what you would consider a classic spy. I get into this all the time. We're not, you know, in the real world. I laugh when we start talking about how, you know, all of these rules that the CIA has to follow. And we've moved so far away from what
they're supposed to do.
Is they're not supposed to follow the rules.
Yep.
They're supposed to go abroad and do really nasty things to people and lie and cheat and bribe and steal to keep us safe.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to go over there and act like they are working for the Justice Department.
Well, the reason I don't like Ben Friedman, I'll tell you very particularly, because he went private in one of your novels. I don't want to give too much details of any of these away, but he went private contractor to make money. And I thought to myself, you know, it could happen, but it disturbs me. That's why I don't like Ben Friedman for that reason.
What? That's a very valid point. But I think, you know, I wanted to make him kind of this nuanced character.
Oh, he is.
Who you kind of begrudgingly respect, But at the same time, you know, he really pisses you off.
And he does what he thinks is in the best interest of Israel as human. Now, that brings me, I'm going to go out of order to Protect and Defend. It's your 2007 novel. It's about Iran. Yep. It's about Hezbollah. It's powerful. It's very important for people who cannot figure out the Iranians, and they don't have the time or the effort they want to put into reading sort of the history of Iran. So go pick up Protect and Defend. You'll get a good idea why Obama's effort to reach out to the mullahs isn't going to work. But you got a character in there. You've got the Ahmadinejad character, but you got a guy named Ashani. He's mildly sympathetic. Not much, but more than the Hezbollah nutter running around, and more than Ahmadinejad, and more than the theocrat at the top of the system. Do you believe such people exist inside of Iran, Vince Flynn?
I do. And now, let me, you know, I'll say this by saying I haven't been there. I'm not welcome. You know, the state news agencies condemn me, you know, and all that fun stuff. So I'm not about to run over there. But I believe in the I believe that basically on this planet that God created, you've got a certain number of people that I've heard the range being one out of every 25 is a sociopath. I think in Iran you see what happens when you get a bunch of sociopaths at the top who control the press and they run the country. I find it almost impossible to believe that there are that many people all the way through the government that are absolutely crazy. And the one area where I think I could glean some proof of that is the fact that even the Supreme Council slaps down Ahmadinejad from time to time.
Yeah, they do. They do.
Because this guy is so far out on a limb. Yeah, you know, he is just he is one of the more unnerving historical figures. And Hugh, I know you talk about this all the time. One of the things today that incenses me more than anything else is that a guy like that can go and say what he says about America and Israel in the well of the United States of the United Nations, and nobody bats an eye.
That's even worse. He gets invited to Colombia to do it. Just mind-boggling.
Could you imagine? And this would have been really interesting. And I know you've met President Bush on many occasions. Could you imagine if he had gone to the UN and said, I am calling for the complete destruction of the country of Iran.
Right.
Paused, watched them all freak out, and then say, I'm just kidding here. I'm trying to make a point that when he comes here and says that about Israel, none of you bat an eye.
Yep.
But when I say it, you know, you're all freaking out.
What do you think is going to, you know, you study this, obviously you had to for that novel and for the other novels. What do you think Israel's going to do about this nuclear program? Because we're not going to do with anything now.
No, we're not going to do anything, and we were kind of really painted into a tough corner the last couple of years because of the economy in Iraq and some other things that were going on. I don't know, Hugh. I don't see what they can do. The problem now is a lot of the program is so far underground, they've got it spread around, that the analysts I've talked to say that short of dropping some tactical nukes, you're going to have a hard time completely taking out the facility. The only crazy kind of game-breaking scenario that I came up with, and I thought it would have been really gutsy, but of course people would have flipped, is if President Bush, as a parting gift, had gone to the UN and said, listen, we've tried to stop Iran from getting a nuke. None of you have taken us seriously. And since you're not going to honor that, what we're going to do to guarantee Israel's security is that we at one point had 16 nuclear missile ballistic submarines that carried 28 warheads apiece. And we are, I think, 8 of them have now been mothballed. We're going to lease them free of charge, 2 of these submarines, for the next 50 years. And one of them will always be at sea, and one of them will always have 28 nuclear warheads on it, capable of wiping out the entire country of Iran, should it be stupid enough to try to attack Israel. Good luck.
Yeah.
And walk away and watch the international community try to come to grips with that whole thing.
I'm kind of hoping they've already got one, may not have 28 warheads on it, but they do have Israeli subs.
And what they do have, what I have been told is they actually have some of them hooked up to cruise missiles, and they are one of them is always kept at sea aboard a destroyer. Should they, you know, in case there really is a sneak attack, they also, of course, have the some missile-launched ones they can use, as well as ones they can drop from airplanes.
They got the temple weapons, as Golda Meir used to call them. I'm going to go to a break. I'll be right back. My guest is Vince Flynn. If you just walked in, yep, It's your lucky day. America's best-selling author. His current bestseller, Extreme Measures, out in bookstores everywhere. We're going to continue the conversation. We're going to get to Mitch Rapp. We've been jumping around a little bit, but we're going to talk about what Hollywood is going to do to this and how they're going to cope with it, because it's a fascinating issue. What happens when Mitch Rapp goes Tinseltown on us, and whether or not Vince Flynn is going to be able to keep the hippies from playing Mitch Rapp and making him into a kinder, gentler Mitch Rapp. I'll be right back, America. 1-800-520-1234 is the number, but don't bother. I don't think you're going to get to use it today. 21 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, talking with Vince Flynn, America's best-selling author of thriller after thriller that reached the New York Times, listening into your homes and in every airport in America. You see him on every plane I've ever been on. Someone's reading your books, Vince. By the way, how often are you recognized? I mean, you've got this picture out there all the time, but nevertheless, how often do people say Vince Flynn and bend your ear?
You know, it happens more and more. I was on a flight from Newark to Orange County this past winter, and it was going to be a long flight. And it had been a long week, and I got on the plane, and sure enough, the woman sitting next to me was reading one of the books. And
oh, no.
She looked at the photo, she looked at me, she looked at the photo, and she looked up at me, and she pointed at the photo, and I said, "No, that happens to me all the time." I guess I look a lot like him. And then I just put on my Bose headphones and and got some work done.
Because that would be a bad... So I was going to ask, I write a lot on airplanes. Can you do it?
You know, I can. I used to not be able to, and now I can. And, of course, it depends how far into the story I am. But, when you've got kids and you're busy, sometimes it's a great little respite to get on one of those planes if you've... I'm fairly tall, so it's got to be up in first class or it's not a respite. And then, be able to kick back and just get some solitude, listen to some music and write.
Now, do you coach your kids' sports teams?
Oh, geez, that's funny. I coached I have a 13-year-old stepson, and I coached his sixth grade football team last year.
And Mitch Rapp on the sidelines.
Oh, and you know what I learned, Hugh? I learned that I am not emotionally equipped to coach my own children. And I had coached him, in basketball and football for many years. But as it started to get more serious, and we literally were in the playoffs, and we were up by two touchdowns with 2 minutes to go, and the boys imploded. And I won't get into the specifics, but they imploded, and we lost the game. We go over to the huddle, and Big Coach Healy, who went to St. John's and tried out with the Saints, he's about 6'6". He's telling all the boys, "Well, those are tough breaks, and it was a fun year." And I looked at him and I said, "Wait a minute."
Oh no!
I said, if I could take it back, I said, "Wait a minute." I said, "Guys, I'm not going to sit here and play this game of political correctness and everything's fine. It isn't fine." And I said, "You know what? If you guys want to ever play football in high school or maybe college, you got to take that feeling, that pain in your stomach right now, and you got to chew on it, and you got to go out and you got to work."
Gosh.
It sucks.
Oh, gosh. I wish I had a tape
parents,
of that.
The parents are standing 20 feet away, and they're looking at me like I'm psychotic.
Keep the boys away from Vinny. All right, now, let's get back to the other issue about Hollywood. I just don't see – I know a lot of the guys in the business. I stay out of it. I'm on the news side. I'm not on the creative side. But I know – and they're not your people, Vince.
Nope.
And so you've signed a deal. Are you going to write the screenplays, and are you going to promise us that Matt Damon is not going to be Mitch Rapp?
Yeah, well, Matt Damon would never play Mitch Rapp, for starters. But, We got the deal last year, and I had this moment of great anxiety right before I signed it, because I had a lot of friends saying to me, don't let him ruin him. And these contracts in Hollywood are very complicated, and you kind of cross that Rubicon and you're done. Your rights are, you give them away. And if you try to be too stringent, they won't sign the deal because they want creative control. So we had a little 12-hour phone call with Lorenzo de Bonaventura, he and Nick Wexler are behind the idea. And all I wanted from Lorenzo was a promise that he wouldn't wussify Mitch Rapp. And Lorenzo promised it. And I think Lorenzo is one of the best producers out there. I think, and Nick as well, they do a great job. They actually read the books that they buy, which is unusual for that town. They usually read, a one-page treatment that is written by some 21-year-old liberal New York film school graduate. And Lorenzo promised me, do you remember the scene in Consent to Kill where Mitch Rapp takes the son of the wealthy Saudi and he puts the suicide vest on him?
Oh, you bet. Oh, you bet.
He drugs him and sends him out, and he and the dad comes out of the mosque and he blows up. And then you flash to the guy who runs the, you know, Saudi security service, and he's saying, how can this be? You know, we do suicide bombs. They don't do suicide bombs.
Right.
And Lorenzo's promised me, because that's the book they're trying to make into the movie right now, which actually I'm supposed to see the screenplay next week. Lorenzo said, I want to put that in the movie. That's how badly I want to keep Mitch Rapp the way he is.
Well, you know, that's Consent to Kill they're going to make?
Consent to Kill is where they decided to start.
Wow.
And I think the reason why is they want to add a female side of the story to it, to
sure.
bring that audience in.
Okay.
I know, but it's an interesting idea. And now they all read Extreme Measures over the holiday break, and they and I only say holiday because I'm talking between Christmas and New Year's. I'm not afraid to say Christmas break. they all read it, and they want to put Extreme Measures into production.
Interesting. I would have guessed Act of Treason first because there's some easier characters. You know, Psy mm-hmm. is kind of easy. But if it's going to be Consent to Kill, on my story notes here, page 450, you've got Saudi radicals funding conversions in American prisons. Now, this is a genuine, interesting news hook. It's a very important story. You've got a harsh view of the Saudi radicals. I mean, you've got throughout all your books, you're very eye-opened about this. How are they going to deal with stuff like that? Are they going to find a way to do it? Is it just going to be the blow up and the sort of the central plot? Are they going to put your worldview in?
I think Lorenzo's plan is to have it in there. I ran into so many obstacles every time we tried to sell this thing in Hollywood, the Mitch Rapp franchise. I actually had after Memorial Day, the head of Paramount had read it and told my agent I hated it. It was more Bush than Bush. Now this was back in 2003 or 2004, and to me that showed just how biased that town was. I said, you got to be kidding me. I mean, the whole plot of the story is terrorists want to set off a nuke in Washington, D.C. and New York. You know, not that complicated. And by the way, it's exactly what Al-Qaeda has said they'd like to do. Can we get on the same page and agree that that's a bad idea?
Right.
For all Americans? But no, they... and by the way, this is a little aside. I think that is why that town makes so many bad business decisions, and it's going to start to come back to the middle, at least, I hope, is they let, unlike any other business I've been involved in, they let their own political beliefs really infuse their daily work culture. People say the craziest things about President Bush, the most offensive things they would say them. And now you watch. You get anybody walk in the workforce and they make the kind of callous, classless comments about President Obama, those people, the same people that would say that stuff about President Bush will freak.
And they'll get, you know, I've talked to Andrew Breitbart about this. It is a remarkably closed town, but he's trying to bring some light to it. And again, I hope your movies just sell, because there's a point of view here. We're going to talk about enhanced interrogation techniques and terror and the real world of fighting terrorism and torture in the next hour and a half. But there's a point of view that is never represented ever in Hollywood filmmaking that I hope comes through in the Vince Flynn adaptions of his novels. I'll be right back with Vince Flynn, America's best-selling author. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. An entire show dedicated to a conversation with Vince Flynn, because Vince has influenced so much of your lives. For those of you who've read any of his millions and millions of books that are out there, you know what I'm talking about, those who will be doing so prospectively. Vince Flynn, since we were just talking about Consent to Kill, one of my sidebar notes here, it's one of those odd things I notice. It was dedicated to brothers and sisters Daniel, Patrick, Sheila, Kelly, Kevin, Timothy, and Lucy, whose smile, love, and grace lives on in Lauren, Connor, and Jack. Now, I know you're one of seven. So is Lucy your sister?
Lucy was my my cousin Terry's wife, who was her kids were roughly the same age as, or their kids were roughly the same age as my kids, and she contracted leukemia a few years ago, and it was very, very heartbreaking. She found out the week after New Year's, and 4 weeks later she was gone.
Oh my gosh.
Really kind of caught everybody off guard, you know, 36 years old, beautiful, a real a real tragedy, but, you know, in the end, a real blessing. I always say Lisa and I had another couple that we knew real well, lost their little 13-month-old boy, went to bed and didn't wake up. And, you know, when stuff like that happens, you really realize you have no problems. You don't have anything. You have no right to complain about anything. You know, if you can wake up in the morning and your kids are still breathing, you're a lucky person.
Yep. You are only as happy as your least happy child, one parent told me. I think that's probably true. Let me ask you, in terms of Daniel, Patrick, Sheila, Kelly, Kevin, and Timothy, what do they think of this? I mean, you're their brother. I grew up in a Catholic family. You hit everyone. You knock each other over. You wrestle around the house, all that sort of thing. And now you're this international figure. I'm sure they cut you no slack, but...
No slack.
But what do they think about this?
I don't know, Hugh. I don't put any thought into it. This is where you get me uncomfortable. I read not too long ago, people tend to get stuck at a certain age and they always think of themselves at that age.
Yeah.
And that's what I do. You know, I still live in the same town I grew up in. I still, you know, my best friend from high school is the godfather to one of my daughters, and I'm the godfather to one of his, you know, kids, and I hang out with the same people, and I just try to keep, I don't let it get to me. The one way it's starting to get to me a little bit is the kids have come home, and they're starting to hear stuff here and there at school and stuff, and I say there's the two words that I will not allow in the house, which is the F word and the C word, which is celebrity and famous. And they're starting to buy into that and kind of get this idea that their dad does something, you know, I don't know what it is. I hate to even think about it, but it bugs me because I don't want I got to grow up in such a great household. I don't want my kids to grow up somehow tainted by this.
Influenced by fame and celebrity culture.
Yeah, yeah. So we stay, if I'm on public, I'll tell you what, Lisa and I were just down in Mexico, and Billy Williams, the lead actor in CSI, was at the resort where we were staying, and I mean I'm talking about it's a 4-bedroom house, ultra, you know, really secluded deal. We didn't bother him once, other than saying hello. You know, there were at the time there were three couples there the whole week we were down there, and just let him go be. You know, and maybe part of that's Minnesota too, but I just don't. I would never walk up to a table while someone's eating and say, "Excuse me."
Yep.
And so that some of that started to happen, and it's one thing if Lisa and I are out, it drives her nuts, but I really hate it in front of the kids because I just would like to have them kind of not be affected by it.
But, now, another real world question. You are working at a phenomenal pace. You have turned, I mean, I write a lot of books, but they're nonfiction books, and, you know, they sell 8 copies. The question is, why are you rushing forward with, I mean, 2 a year sort of thing?
Well, it's 1 a year right now, and it's going to stay that way. I would like to branch out and write, you know, kind of a more of an FBI, private eye type thriller based in the United States. But I got to be careful when I do it. And, you know, to be honest, I enjoy writing. And if writing is a discipline, and if you put it off, it's easy to put it off. If they told me I only had to write 2 books, you know, a book every 2 years, I'd write, you know, a book every two years.
Yeah.
And the only thing that makes this hard is with the kids and school and everything, I don't get to travel to do the amount of research that I used to do, which makes it a little more difficult. But then again, I have this knowledge base now, and I have this Rolodex of these people I can call, you know, to do my research. So it's, in many ways, at some point, it's like getting ready for a marathon. You just got to say, all right, you know what? On Monday morning, I better start running.
Yep, I've
got
20.
I got to run that thing in 4 months.
Yeah, I got 20 weeks to. That's so funny you say 4 months. Yeah, I'll be right back. Vince Flynn is my guest, the best-selling author. We continue now. We're going to turn to the big questions of the politics of the novel. Stay where you are. 44 minutes after the hour, America's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Spending the entire conversation with Vince Flynn, America's best-selling author. His brand new book, Extreme Measures, in bookstores across the United States. Of course, it's at Amazon.com. All of his other books are at Amazon.com. If you want the order in which they appeared, I recommend Wikipedia to you, or you can check it out today at HughHewitt.com. I read them that way, but there's no need to do it that way. Okay, Vince Flynn, there's a worldview in these books. How much of that is yours? How much of it simply developed around the character of Mitch Rapp?
You know, it's, somebody finally busted me with this question the other day, because people always say, are you Mitch Rapp? And I'm like, no, I'm not Mitch Rapp. You know, of course I'm not Mitch Rapp. And somebody finally said to me, on what things do you and Mitch Rapp disagree on?
Good question. Great question.
I was like, well, now you say it that way, we really don't disagree on a lot of things. Yeah, it's my worldview. And it's a fairly, you know, it's a little all over the board, but I tend to believe that the people who we should support are the men and women who make less than a bus driver in Washington, D.C., who work 7 days a week, who put their lives on the line. These are the men and women, you know, at the clandestine service, the CIA, the overseas teams in the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Special Forces and the military. These are the people we should be giving our almost unflinching support to. I have, in the last couple of years, taken an, if it's possible, an even more callous view of our political leaders in Washington.
Oh, that's clearly true in the most recent book, that and easily turned once the toll of terrorism comes home. But it's hard to get more callous by the end of this, except I think we're entering an era where we will even fall off the floor here, eventually.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that, and I know you talk about this all the time, but the thing that gets me just shaking my head is the way the politicians get away with it. That they can stand up like they did in the 70s and 80s and neuter the CIA and miss opportunity after opportunity in the 90s to deal with this issue of Islamic radical fundamentalism. And then when 9/11 hits, act absolutely shocked that it went down. And now pull it to the financial debacle and especially the mortgage crisis. These, we've got to be careful that I don't let loose any profanity.
No FCC violations, please. Yeah,
these individuals on Capitol Hill, why are they there? It is their entire job, one of their most important jobs, to make sure that this stuff doesn't happen, to regulate, to hold hearings, to legislate. And what do? They were all at the switch when this thing blew up, and now they act shocked, and they want to blame some CEO for flying in a G5, that somehow is going to, you know, explain away the problem. And I know, you know, Barney Frank, and
Well, let me ask you about, I agree about the political types, and we can come back to them, but what's much more interesting in the novels is that you have to carry forward, and you do, a double-breasted approach to the agencies, because, like you, I've happened to know a lot of people who served as undercover operatives in the clandestine services, and they, like any bell curve, there's going to be great, there are going to be terrible ones, and there are going to be most of them in between. And you've got good ones and bad ones in the CIA, but you also have wonder workers. And I'm wondering, does a Marcus Drummond really exist, do you think?
The types, yes, they do.
That's amazing.
Well, and maybe not as rolled into one person as he is. Maybe not as illegal as he is, but they do have their teams that are capable of doing some pretty amazing things, technology-wise.
That's good to know. Now, you've got some people like Peter Cameron. Again, he appears in the third option. He's a rogue former CIA agent who's just gone out for the money and does very nasty things for the money. You think such of those people exist?
Well, and again, I always have to be careful. I don't want to offend any friends. You know, Blackwater's in the news again today.
Yep.
And Blackwater, I like Eric Prince. I know him personally, and I think Blackwater, you know, unfortunately got caught in the middle of a big fight between the State Department and the Defense Department, and the idea that a lot of people whose livelihood depends on it, the Pentagon, didn't like an outfit like Blackwater running around doing what it was doing. But having said that, you know, Blackwater employed some cowboys that probably didn't practice some restraint, you know, that they should have practiced. And it's nothing to take lightly. And I think there is quite a few ex-guns for hire who have been out working all over the place. And it didn't just start with the beginning of the Gulf War, or excuse me, the Iraqi freedom. But it's been going on for quite some time. And you've seen it over the years when you've got, you know, former, you know, SEALs and Green Berets and Delta guys going down and running the security operations for, you know, some drug dealers in South America.
Right.
And it's just like you said, you're going to have your bell curve. You're going to have some bad apples. But that doesn't mean you should paint, you know, the entire special forces community as a bunch of, mercenaries.
Of course not. In fact, you mentioned Marcus Luttrell earlier. I had a chance to interview him down the deck of the Midway a while back. I think, if anything, they're getting squarer. I've gotten to know these guys because I've supported. They're getting more and more square than they must have used to been. In fact, when you describe in Executive Power the training on pages 236 to 237 that goes down on the Strand there, you know, they must wash out all of the sociopaths at this point.
I think they've, well, and then there was an argument that right there back in 02 through 05, quite a few of the folks down at Bragg and out of Coronado were getting upset that they were being told, you got to not be so harsh on some of these people because we need some numbers. And they didn't like that. You know, they said, go ahead and send more of them to jump school. Do whatever you do. Set up new units. But we don't want to lower our standards. Because, you know, if you read in Lone Survivor, and it's not uncommon, you know, basically you're looking at 160 guys going to a class, and if you're lucky, if 30 graduate.
Right. That's very amazing. And
you, none of them are wusses going in.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you'd look at him and go, oh, he's going to drop for sure.
Well, you say, you have a line here. I scored it when I was reading through it. The men who ran the Naval Special Warfare Center in Coronado needed to find out who could take it, because in the real world of special operations, quitting was not an option. I'd actually never thought about that as clearly as that until after, in the course of reading Executive Power. You don't get to say I'm tired, do you?
No.
You don't get to be a radio host. You know, I'm going to take tomorrow off, Dwayne. Run the Vince Flynn special. I'll be right back, America. Vince Flynn is my guest. Extraordinary novelist. Great, great series of books. They're listed at HughHewitt.com. Don't go anywhere. Good back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Concluding hour number two with one more hour to go. Talking with Vince Flynn, the author of so many extraordinary bestsellers, including the current one, Extreme Measures, in bookstores across the United States. Vince Flynn, do you watch 24?
I do.
What do you think?
This year I have not. Well, I actually was down at Rush's and got to see the first four. First 4 hours back in when was that? November? Yeah, November. But other than that, I haven't been able to watch it on TV this year because of some traveling. But they're TiVo'd right now. I consulted on season 5.
Oh, you did?
So, yep.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's pretty interesting. How was that?
It was a lot of fun. They're a real interesting group of guys. Joel Surnow and Bob Cochran, the creators, are now off the show. But real interesting birds. You know, Bob Cochran is just, the guy's an absolute genius. Joel is this, you know, frenetic ball of energy who kind of pushes people to come up with newer and better ideas. And Howard Gordon, who now is running the show, he's about one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet in Hollywood.
You know, it's very interesting. You're very eclectic in your choices of friends. And in the books, you'll throw off stuff. I'm looking at my notes here. Separation of Power, a little conversation between Mitch and another character. I won't give it away. Washington Times versus Washington Post, and how you can, you know, tweak people. So you're very knowing about your media inputs. How much are you out there when you're not writing and isolated, taking in media? Obviously, you're a talk radio junkie, but what about the other stuff?
I inhale it.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, I was one of these kids who, on Sunday morning, I'd get up. And again, you know, we had there was nothing on TV back then. And I'd get up and I'd watch, you know, Meet the Press. This week or whatever. And because that's all that was on.
Yeah.
And I'd, you know, sit there and eat my cereal and get ready to go to mass.
Yeah. Now, by the way, you an altar boy?
Of course.
Just checking. Now, you listen to Rush. You listen to me. I'm very flattered by that. What other talkers you listen to?
I listen to Glenn from time to time. There's a great guy here in town called Joseph.
Oh,
Rick,
Joe's wonderful, yeah.
Who's got, you know, the show Garage Logic, who is his producer, the rookie, Matt Mikowski, is one of my high school buddies. And so I love that show. You know, I listen to Laura in the morning. It kind of depends when I'm out and what I'm doing.
Okay, and I hope you're listening to Medved and Prager. I have to put that in.
I do. I do listen to both of them. For some reason, unfortunately for Michael, Suchere and he are on at the same time.
Right.
Prager's on the same time as Rush, but I'll skip back and forth between. I'm going to say this about you and Dennis, and I think Suchere is the same way. You guys have this great talent of not letting people get under your skin.
Well, that's, yeah. Amen.
And keeping things intellectual, entertaining, and humorous, which is not an easy balance to strike.
Well, one guy has gotten under my skin. His name's Jay Larson. I'm wondering if you could arrange to have him killed. He's the guy over at the Patriot. Can we have that done with your contacts?
Are you serious?
No, okay, I'll let him live again. I'm coming right back. Hour number three with Vince Flynn, the author of so many wonderful books. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.